Namo Buddhaya.
The Middle Way.
Namo.
The Story of Buddhism.
Dhammaya.
By Jinananda.
Namo Sanghaya.
The Buddhist Way is guided by three
Namo
ideals,
Namo.
Traditionally known as the Three Jewels. These are the Buddha, the Dharma, the teachings, and the Sangha, practicing Buddhists. The first jewel, the Buddha. In the 6th century BC, at about the same time as Greek thinkers were laying the foundations of science and philosophy that have created the essential features of Western civilization, a man, sitting beside a river one night in ancient India, was initiating an equally unparalleled project. Buddhists believe that what this man discovered opened up the possibility for anyone who makes the effort of seeing directly into the nature of reality. The directions this man offered to his followers are said to constitute a program by which the limitations of human existence, circumscribed as it is by impermanence, by disease, old age, and death, may be left behind in a radical transformation of the mind. The beginnings and ends of Buddhism lie here, in the faith that there is a literally infinite range of development available to the possessor of self-awareness. And the first to realize these possibilities, the first to awaken from the dream of a closed reality, was the man accorded the title of Buddha. That is, one who is awake. No one who saw the gaunt figure dressed in rags, sitting motionless all day and night, would have seen anything out of the ordinary. Meditating ascetics were not an unusual sight in India, then as now. Yet we have all seen images of this particular man sitting, with legs crossed, eyes lowered, on this particular night. Decisive energy is in the unshakable poise of his posture, ineffable wisdom and bottomless compassion in his half-smile. This image remains 2,500 years later the archetypal symbol in the West, as in the East, of the spiritual quest. Who was this man? Where did he come from? Was he human or divine? To answer this question, we have first to discard any notion we may have that to be human is to be merely human, the creation of some divine being or creative principle called God. Only then may we say that the Buddha was born a human being. Balanced between the animal realm and putative forms of more refined existence, and partaking of both, human beings are not regarded by Buddhists as inherently limited, sinful, fallen creatures. They are understood rather as being ideally placed to see into the nature of the conditioned existence common to all life, at whatever level, animal, human, or divine. This means that there is no danger of deifying the Buddha, because if he were a god, he could not be a Buddha. The Buddha-to-be, Siddhartha Gautama, later known as Shakyamuni, or the sage of the Shakyas, was born to a leading family of the Shakya Republic. This was a prosperous warrior people of the clan Gautama, occupying a region the size of an English county in the foothills of the Himalayas between what is now India and Nepal. His father, Suddhodana, was the elected head of an hereditary ruling class, or oligarchy. Later, as all the republican states were absorbed by the great kingdoms of the Ganges basin, Siddhartha came to be described anachronistically as a prince, but in fact, the Buddha's upbringing was better than royal. Rather than suffering the idle luxury and sycophancy due to a prince, he grew up confident, urbane, and intelligent. He was skilled in the arts of peace and war and looked up to nobody. There are various differing accounts of the birth of the Buddha-to-be. In all, the historical facts are coloured by legend, the stuff of the traditional vivid Indian imagination.
Queen Mahamaya bore the Bodhisattva for 10 months, like oil, in a bowl. And when her time approached, she asked leave to go to her own family at Devadaha. On the way, she halted at the gardens of Lumbini, where the sala trees were in full flower, the air hummed with bees and the birds sported and sang. In the grove, she reached up to a branch which swayed down to meet her hand, and as she took hold of it, she felt the pangs of birth begin. A curtain was set up about her, and holding to the branch, she was delivered. The four great gods of purity caught the bodhisattva in a net of gold. Two streams of water fell down from the sky onto the mother and child. And then he stood on the earth, and in every direction before him lay many thousands of worlds, and in them gods and men making offerings to him and saying, "There is none here your equal." Then he took seven steps. "I am the chief in the world," he roared his lion's roar. He was lustrous and steadfast as the sun, and when the people looked upon him, he held their gaze like the moon.
For all his beauty and strength, however, and indeed on that very account, the boy was a source of great anxiety to his father. He was such from the day of his birth, when a venerable sage called Ashita had learned from the gods of the birth of the great bodhisattva, and had come down from the Himalayas to look upon him. Examining the boy carefully, Ashita recognized in him all the marks of a Buddha. These signs, including the familiar protuberance on the top of the head and the lengthened ears, are seen not on the physical body, but on the subtle body, invisible to general view, the body that, according to ancient tradition, more closely expresses the Buddha's true nature. So Ashita read these signs and prostrated himself before the child. As he did so, he wept, because he himself would be dead before he could be taught by the Buddha, and instead of gaining enlightenment, he would be spending incalculable eons in the highest heaven. Meanwhile, Suddhodana was gratified at the great seer's awestruck reverence before his son, but was also aware that he was losing control of his son's destiny. How might he divert Siddhartha from the course that the great seer had predicted for him? The marks of a Buddha were also the marks of a great emperor, and for the sake of the survival of the small Shakyan state in an unstable political situation, the boy's future greatness needed to be a political one. The very name given to his son, Siddhartha, which means he whose aim will be accomplished, would remind him of the vigilance he had to exercise in order to make sure that nothing in Siddhartha's life could possibly awaken him from the dream of mundane life even for a moment. Although his mother died 7 days after his birth, Siddhartha was thereafter protected from anything that might alert him to the harsher realities of temporal existence, anything that might jolt him out of his full confidence in the joys of life. Indeed, Siddhartha plunged into his pleasures as if he would tear the heart out of them, and cared not for the purse-lipped priests or the pleas for moderation from his family, though his warmth and wit and kindness always melted their disapproval. His training was not in religion or philosophy, but in driving a war chariot, javelin throwing, swordsmanship and archery. These were the accomplishments his social position required of him, and he brought power and precision and a competitive edge to all of them. When he was 16, he won his bride, called Yashodhara, through his supreme prowess against all comers with the bow. Siddhartha was also surrounded by courtesans, the most skilled in all the sensual arts. Much later, he reminisced on his early years.
"I was very delicately raised. In my father's mansion, pools were made in which lotuses flowered, red or blue or white. I used no sandalwood that was not of Benares. All my apparel, my turban, my tunic, my cloak, was of Benares cloth. Night and day, a white parasol was held over me that I should not be troubled by the elements. I had three palaces, one for the winter, one for the summer, and one for the rains. For the 4 months of the rains, entertained by female minstrels, I did not come down from the palace."
Thus, The world Siddhartha lived in conspired to hide from him all the most disagreeable facts of life. In this, his situation was that of any happy, untroubled youth, intoxicated with his own vitality and oblivious of the decline and mortality to come. However, in Siddhartha's case, reality eventually broke in upon him with such overwhelming force that he could not thereafter shut it away again. This event is known as the Legend of the Four Sights. Siddhartha resolved one day to go out and see the sights of his native city, and his father, hearing of this, ordered that any people that were sick or maimed in body or mind should be kept indoors, so that the prince might not be distressed by what he saw in his progress. So Siddhartha set out with his charioteer, and he marveled at the beauty he saw around him. While the people, in their turn, delighted in the noble grace of his countenance and bearing, for he was radiant with youth, his eyes clear, his hair coal black. Suddenly his attention was transfixed by a human figure unlike any other he had ever seen. It was a decrepit old man.
"Who is this man holding a staff, charioteer, with white hair and shuffling gait, his form bent, his eyes hidden beneath his brows? Why is he thus?"
"That is old age, sir, by which he is broken down. The ravisher of beauty, the ruin of vigour, the cause of sorrow, the destruction of delights, the bane of memories, the enemy of the senses."
"Surely this condition is not common."
"It is common to all the world, sir, and we must be content to have it so."
Siddhartha was thunderstruck. Returning to the palace, he found it empty of happiness. Seeking for some diversion, he went out with his charioteer again, and once again his eye was caught by something he had never seen, at least never taken notice of before.
"Yonder man, with a swollen belly, panting and shaking, his arms hanging loose, his face pale and staring. What is this creature?"
"He is afflicted, sir, with sickness. We are all subject to this evil."
"Alas for the scattered intelligence of men who can enjoy tranquility in the midst of such calamity. Turn back, O charioteer!"
Siddhartha trembled, it is said, like the moon reflected in ruffled waters. He went home, but he took no pleasure there. And so, yet again, he went out in his chariot, and yet again he beheld a strange sight.
"Who is this charioteer that lies adorned and appearing not to breathe, borne by four men and followed by mournful companions?"
"This is a dead man, sir. A man who is finished with. His body will be disposed of like mere wood or straw. It is the final end of all beings, whoever they are."
"If this be the end appointed to all beings, how are the hearts of men so composed? How can a rational being stay heedless here in the hour of calamity?"
All these three sights had shaken Siddhartha to the core. The fourth, however, was of a radically different nature, though it had quite as powerful an impact. Riding out once more, his mind gripped by thoughts of the ineluctable end of all that he cherished in the world, Siddhartha caught sight of a man dressed not in the usual white garb, but in an old yellow robe, and going barefoot from door to door with a begging bowl. There was in this beggar's manner, his comportment, his way of moving and looking, something that the prince obscurely recognized. There was a sense of composure and warmth, an unshakable integrity about him to which Siddhartha found himself responding from some deeply buried understanding of his own. "What manner of man is this?" he asked, "so untouched as he appears by the sorrows and delights of mortal beings. Is he a god, perhaps?" The charioteer, called Chana, explained that the man was a Shramana, or religious mendicant. These Shramanas were not like the Brahmins, the hereditary priestly caste that was traditionally entrusted with the task of placating the gods with sacrifices. Rather than negotiating with a higher power on behalf of the world, they had renounced the world altogether. rather than simply securing a better rebirth within samsara, which means the going on and on of things, they had embarked on a search for the truth that would win deliverance from the whole realm of life and death. They sought a truth that would be relevant not to society at large, but to the existential situation of the individual, whatever their position within society. Such seekers after truth wander India to this day, even as the caste system, from Brahmin to untouchable, still dominates Indian society. Siddhartha's reflections at this time were already planting the seeds of his enlightenment. He was setting himself a clear agenda that only enlightenment could fulfill.
Domestic life is stifling and dusty. The going forth as a wanderer is wide open. It is not easy to lead a holy life as utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell while cabined at home. Why do I seek what is liable to birth, to aging, to decay, to death, to stain, to sorrow? Being myself liable to birth, to aging, to decay, to death, to stain, to sorrow, I should seek the unborn, the unaging, the undecaying, the deathless, the stainless, the sorrowless.
Thus Siddhartha resolved to break out of his gilded cage, to go forth from the world. He returned to the palace to learn that his wife had borne him a son. The boy was named Rahula, and that night there was feasting and rejoicing. Siddhartha now had everything to stay for, but there was nothing, not power, not luxury, not love, not attachment to his family, that could be set in the balance to outweigh the adamantine resolution of his heart. He was letting everyone down. He was leaving everyone he loved. But he had to go. Having seen the absurdity of mundane life, he could no longer take any of it seriously. At midnight, he awoke, took a last look at his sleeping wife and child, blinked the brimming tears from his eyes, and called for his faithful charioteer to saddle his favorite horse. It is said that the gods muffled the horse's hooves and made the great gates of the city to swing open without a sound, so that the two of them were able to reach the border with the kingdom of Magadha unchallenged. There Siddhartha cut off his beard and his hair and said farewell to his charioteer and his horse. Then he exchanged his jeweled clothes for the rags of a beggar, and when the now very splendid tramp had gone his way, Siddhartha was on his own. So began his long and terrible journey towards enlightenment. The legends may give the impression that the Buddha was born to be enlightened, that he was destined through innumerable lifetimes to be the foremost being in the universe. In some sense, perhaps he was, but in fact, he achieved that position of lofty eminence through his own efforts as a human being. That is, through struggle, confusion, and wrong turnings. Like any other man, he had always to consider that he might be mistaken. His first meal, coarse scraps left over from the midday fare of a simple peasant community, made him vomit just to look at it. But if he was to direct an unflinching gaze at the human condition, he had to begin by sharing the most basic experiences of humanity without turning away in disgust, and so he soon overcame his delicacy. Then, when the time came to rest, at night, in the middle of the forest, he found he could not sleep, his mind a prey to all manner of nameless fears and horrors. He knew he must face down such terrors, so he took to staying alone in haunted places, in charnel grounds, in strange and ancient shrines. He discovered in time that he could gradually overcome his fear by simply not giving any expression to it whatsoever, by not reacting in any way to the rustling of beasts and unearthly screechings in the forest, in short, by remaining mindful. Eventually, Siddhartha found a teacher of good repute called Alara Kalama, who would, he had heard, be able to introduce him to a method of directly experiencing the truth. This forest mendicant's teaching was aimed at realizing a supersensory state of ecstatic freedom from attachment. Siddhartha began by finding a secluded place free from distractions, and then he further quietened the senses by sitting perfectly still. He learned to withdraw his attention and interest from all sensory input by focusing on one single sense object, like the breath, and in this way to become aware of the thoughts that passed through his mind. As he did so, those thoughts arising from attachment or ill will, anxiety and restlessness, dullness or doubt and indecision, gradually gave way to contentment and charity, rapture, stillness and confidence. In this way, all the scattered energies of negative emotion gradually unified in absorption around a single object of attention. As all mental activity whatsoever fell away, the deepening concentration of all his physical, emotional, and mental faculties released a wellspring of joyful energy, opening out into an immensity of bliss, and then going beyond all the most super-subtle sensory pleasures to arrive at an undiluted alertness. Alara Kalama then taught him to spread his attention beyond the limitations of a particular object until his mind met with no perceptible object whatsoever. This he called the sphere of infinite space. Then Siddhartha learned to realize this sphere of infinite space as being not other than his own mind, his own consciousness, and thus mastered the sphere of infinite consciousness. Finally, he realized that this infinite consciousness was no thing at all, and so attained the sphere of nothingness, a vibrant emptiness of both subject and object. Siddhartha was the spiritual prodigy that every teacher dreams of. Alara Kalama at once invited him to share his seat at the head of the school. However, Siddhartha was already leaving his teacher behind in his reflections on the meaning of his experience. If mystical absorption constituted freedom from worldly attachments, it was only temporary. The roots of attachment remained to sprout again. He recognized that it was not enough to escape into a realm of bliss to be reborn in heaven. He was already seeing visions of things to come and finding occult powers in his hands. When evening fell, he would walk with gods and angels, and they told him much that was good and useful about how he too might enjoy what seemed to them to be an eternity of bliss. But Siddhartha saw what they did not. He saw that even the gods were on the same wheel of life and death as was humanity. The difference was that as a human being, at least one knew where one was, that any existence was indeed impermanent. As a god, one was that much more out of touch with reality. Siddhartha was tempted to stay on. Perhaps he might continue his search for the truth with the support of this excellent community of mendicants, who were all gratifyingly awestruck at his staggering facility in meditation. But no, to accept a position of spiritual responsibility and authority before he had reached his goal could lead only to complacency. He gratefully declined Alara's offer. So he moved on to the feet of another teacher, Udraka Ramaputra, who schooled him in the attainment of an even more refined meditative absorption. Siddhartha was taught to let go even of the non-perception that was the sphere of nothingness, inasmuch as one cannot have perception without an object. And thus, he came to realize the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, that is, of neither form nor formlessness. This was a state of freedom from all conceptualization whatsoever. Again, however, like any meditative state, it was only a temporary refuge from the limitations of human existence. So again, he thanked his teacher and went on his way. He had already decided on his next move. If it was impossible, ultimately, to escape from the world, he would turn around and fight it on its own level, tear up the roots of craving by sheer force. He travelled through the kingdom of Magadha till he came to a beautiful grove on the banks of the Naranjara in a locality called Uruvela, in what is now the state of Bihar. Here he stopped. Without a teacher, he took up the most arduous and inhuman of all spiritual paths, and it proved to be an appalling mistake, leading him nearly to his death. This was the practice of self-mortification. Its rationale was based on the idea of an immortal soul. Systematic self-torture was designed to break the link between body and soul, to free the supposedly real self from the tyranny of the flesh. He had tried the gentle approach. Now he would attempt to burn out with pure physical suffering the attachment to the world that held him to the endless cycle of birth and death. For 6 years and more, there was no one who went as close to the limits of human endurance as Siddhartha did. The fame of his austerities carried his name far and wide, like a great bell sounding in the canopy of the sky. He started to attract disciples of his own. Here is how he later described some of the practices that he inflicted upon himself during those years.
I thought, what if I were to meditate without breathing? When I did this, there was a loud noise of winds coming through my ears like the blowing of a blacksmith's bellows. When I stopped my ears as well, it was as if a leather strap were being twisted round my head. It was as if a skillful butcher were cutting my belly open. It was as if I were held over a roasting fire. But whatever the pain, it did not overcome my mind. I thought, what if I were to take only so much daily food as my hollowed hand could hold? When I did this, my limbs became like vine stems. My spine was like a row of spindles. My ribs were like the rafters of an uncovered barn. My eyes were like the gleam of water at the bottom of a well. My scalp was like a shriveled gourd. I could feel my backbone through my belly. And if I performed my bodily functions, I fell over onto my face. When I rubbed my limbs, a hair came away from my skin.
In this way, Siddhartha explored the deepest recesses of physical suffering, just as in his youth he had relished all the sensual luxury that the world had to offer, and just as more recently he had explored the highest reaches of meditative bliss. What he had found in each case was a dead end. Even his pain he had found to be a source of attachment. As soon as he saw this, he resolved to be done with it. He ate his first proper meal in years, and with it he tasted also the bitterness of failure, that all his pain had been for nothing. But he identified this moment of despair as a greater failure and dismissed it. And then he fell to considering what might be the fundamental flaw in the principle behind asceticism. When his friends came with his pitiful daily ration of food, they found that he'd already begged a healthy bowlful from a passing farmer and had eaten what he could of it while resting in the shade, instead of taking advantage of the midday sun to develop a more serious headache. They were aghast. Siddhartha's explanations were cut off with derision. They left in misery, cast adrift on their endless ocean of self-torment, without the great Siddhartha Gautama, the northern star of ascetics, to lead them on. As for Siddhartha, it seemed as if he were back where he'd started. He was on his own. He was a nobody. Once again, he had no precise idea of the path before him. Once again, he was working blind, chipping away in the dark at the same unyielding rock face. However, the years he had spent in taming body and mind had left him with immense reserves of spiritual stamina, and as he stopped struggling over imaginary obstacles, as he dropped the intellectual, emotional, and moral baggage that was tied up with his ascetic practices, he experienced a massive release of energy and clarity. The breakthrough was even then imminent. Siddhartha was shortly to begin meditating for the last time. When he arose again, he would have transcended the world of gods and men, and he would be another form of being altogether, a being described simply as awake. The final component required for this transformation was actually quite rudimentary. He located it in a memory of when he was a boy, watching his father performing a ceremony to inaugurate the ploughing season. He remembered how he had been sitting to one side in the shade of a rose-apple tree, and how his nursemaids had been drawn away by the sound of music and laughter, as his father handled a gilded plough drawn by garlanded white oxen to turn over the first furrow. They had returned to find him sitting effortlessly still, and they were relieved to see that by some miracle he had been untouched by the sun moving round the sky. He had slipped quite spontaneously into a state of fully integrated absorption, of lucid awareness, an unforced state in which all his faculties flowed with ease in the direction of his attention. This was no higher realm of experience. It was the ordinary human realm at its happiest, when all the weight of the world, its craving and hatred, lifts from the heart, and one feels peace and joy. This was the middle way, where purified experience could meet clear thought and lucidity of purpose. Somewhere between altered states of consciousness and philosophical investigations, there was a point of balance, a natural state of undistracted attentiveness, where genuine transformation could take place. Mindfulness was the pivot on which he could shift his consciousness free of everything that came before it and go beyond it. No conceptual formulation or divine revelation or transcendental experience would be allowed to ground the endless exploration of reality before him. Mindfulness, the middle way, would give him the wings he needed. Siddhartha started to feel his way back to that spontaneous boyhood experience. He had, of course, already rejected meditative experience as an end in itself. He had perceived that ultimate liberation was not about escaping from the world into another higher heaven realm. Now, at last, he saw where ultimate liberation would come from. It would come from looking at conditioned existence and understanding how it worked, and then dismantling it, so that there might be no going back to the world of pain and confusion, because it would not be there to go back to, or even to escape from. He was going back to the practices he had learned from his two teachers in order to use them as the means to a realization that would be essentially moral and cognitive, as well as experiential. A transformation of being rather than just a transformation of experience. His mastery of meditation gave him a malleable, brilliant, and emotionally positive concentration, like gold melted and purified by a goldsmith before it is fashioned into an ornament. But such a faculty had for him now only one purpose. This was to magnify and purify his mind's view of its own processes, and to allow the shattering conclusions that must ultimately be drawn from that objective and supremely focused observation to be fully acknowledged and embraced without putting his sanity at risk. A whole raft of rigid views and fixed emotional attitudes had recently foundered on the rocks of his realization that self-torture was useless. Above all, he saw that the truth is not separate from the way it is held, that it is an attitude, a way of being, not a set of conclusions. He saw that any fixed view he held of the nature of things, of himself, of the religious life, and of the issues he confronted, simply bound him more tightly to conditioned existence. He watched the remains of all his old unconscious assumptions drift away. He was looking for the solution to a supremely practical issue, and for that he had to discard everything that could not justify itself in purely practical terms. Anything the mind might close around and secure itself to would now halt the process of awakening. Useful as a fixed marker might be in guiding him to the goal, he had to be ready at any time to uproot it and let it go. Now again he sat beneath a tree, this time a banyan tree, regarded as sacred by the local village people. and a beautiful woman called Sujata, dressed in a deep blue robe, came with an offering for the tree of specially prepared milk rice sweetened with wild honey. Seeing Siddhartha there, with the blaze of his coming enlightenment already alight in his eyes, she naturally took him to be the god of the tree and offered him the food. It was food fit for a god, and he ate it gratefully. Then he bathed in the sacred river and afterwards rested in a grove of sal trees. Finally, he made his way to the foot of a fig tree of the variety Ficus religiosa, a descendant of which still stands in the same place by the Naranjara River at what is today known as Bodh Gaya. A grass cutter came by and gave him 8 handfuls of Munja grass, and out of these Siddhartha made a seat for himself, facing east. He was now fully refreshed, nourished, and comfortable. But in thus adopting a more balanced, harmonious, human approach, Siddhartha was not relaxing the intensity of his quest. His confidence in the possibility of release by means of insight into the fundamental processes of conditioned existence, by means of a direct intuition of the ineffable nature of reality, became unshakable.
Skin, sinew, and bone may wither away. Flesh and blood may dry up. But without attaining complete enlightenment, I shall not leave this seat.
With this vow, this declaration of intent, Siddhartha aroused all the demonic forces of the world against him. Such was his clarity of mind that these forces could no longer operate invisibly within his mind. Instead, he knew them as they truly are. The god of death, called Mara, the evil one, lord of all the realms of pain, summoned his terrible and numberless cohorts, all the fathomless terrors and longings, resentments and evasions and vanities of the world, in a final assault on the bodhisattva's spirit, to halt him in his tracks. Nothing had prepared Siddhartha for the wrenching desperation of this struggle. Always he had known mastery over himself, but now that very mastery was to be renounced. That effortless freedom of spirit he had already attained had to be surrendered. He saw the path towards his goal disappear before him as the last gates of the world slowly began to close behind him. He was about to lose everything, all the familiar patterns of existence that he had known for lifetime after lifetime. There would be nothing to hold on to, nothing to stand firm upon. All the meaning and significance of life as he knew it would be burnt to nothing in the fire of transformation he was approaching. Horror and fear exploded out from the depths of his mind. Mara's host assumed the hideous forms of nightmare, roaring imprecations that travelled around the universe, filling every empty extremity of space with hatred and terror. It was as if an obscure but dreadful and limitless rage threatened to bury him in the deepest ocean or pulverize him in a bolt of lightning. But he maintained his equanimity. He did not flinch, he did not react or close his heart. The weapons that Mara's host hurled against him, arrows, spears, hot coals, fell to the earth as flowers or hung in the air as sweet perfume. So now Mara tried a different tack. He brought forward his daughters to dance before the bodhisattva. With eyes that promised all the ravishing sweetness of love, with lips warm and ripe for tasting, the skin of their breasts firm and like silk to the touch, and the moving of their flanks like the branches of a young tree swaying before the soft breezes of spring, Mara's daughters searched for a response of the very slightest flicker of sensual distraction, anything that might serve to unravel Siddhartha's concentration. But as the fierce energy of life ran hot through his blood, Siddhartha sat on, still and composed, and Mara's daughters searched in vain. As the sun went down, Shakyamuni's mind became completely clear and integrated, responsive and focused, unhindered, free-moving. He returned to the practice of meditation that he had developed under his old teachers. He entered into increasingly refined realms of supersensory experience, But whatever he experienced, he allowed no such pleasure as arose in him to gain power over his mind. All the mystical fruits of a saintly life, with their promise of the seemingly endless joys of heaven, were now not enough to even snag at his attention. He turned back to face the world, life, reality. Years, indeed lifetimes of learning, observation and thought, of moral effort, generosity and kindness, of meditation, contemplation and stillness, had steadily and gently, day by day, accumulated a weight and concentration of purpose that had finally reached a critical mass. Now at last, the pure glory of life was breaking through.